Hello, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limewalk Technical Mess. We're here every Sunday night at 8 o'clock. And just to remind you of the huge links to be aware of, if you need to reach via email, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, if you... one sec. Okay, we may have some problems with my linear amplifier tonight, but we'll try and get through it, I guess. Anyway, once again, if you want to reach me by email to either give a question, mail that question, or a topic of discussion, or a puzzle to share with everyone, or you want me to ask Paul to take a look at something NASA or space-related, please do. It's mailbag@ac2gs.com. I have a link page, a whole bunch of interesting links, a picture that Paul sent me for the SpaceNet report, and a bunch of other things, some interesting YouTube. That's available at my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. There's a chat room available. You can either go to Limewalk's own website and get the link there and log on to the chat room, or you can just type into the browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you directly to the chat room. And as I often remind people, I stream Limewalk's Glen Oaks repeater, W2VL, over the internet. I try and do it 24/7. So if you don't have a radio and you'd like to listen to what's going on in the repeater, just point a browser with an internet access to technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the audio feed for Limewalk's Glen Oaks repeater. And as always, I'd like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive of technical mess going back to September of 2006, and that's available at his website, which is amateurradio.tv. So please avail yourself of it. He's gotten, he told me, his 1 millionth hit recently. So it's an active website. The only active net that he archives these days, unfortunately, is the Limewalk Technical Net. All the other nets have kind of faded away. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you about what I have planned for you tonight. Okay. Well, the plan is we'll take questions or topics for discussion. I'll ask for the person's first name and call sign and write them down in order, and we'll try and address them as best we can in order. Later on, we'll open it up for general discussions of anything related to technology or science or generalizations of medicine. I have a puzzler tonight. Thankfully, it was an idea that Paul, WS2N, had. So hopefully that will be a seed of discussion later on. So I'm looking forward to that. And then at around 10:15 or so, Paul, WS2N, will bring us his SpaceNet report. That'll take us to about 11 o'clock in night, and I'll come back, tie a bow on it, and wish you well. So assuming that the repeater behaves, that my RM Italy behaves, and my radio behaves, that's the idea for tonight. So if anyone out there has any questions or topics of discussion or comments, or they were here some other episode of the Technical Net and to discuss a problem that they addressed and the results that they'd like to tell us how it all worked out, because we always like to hear happy endings. So please, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, that's interesting. It sounds like that Pennsylvania station is having some kind of a thing going on, and propagation conditions have allowed them to kind of get into the repeater. Which is interesting, since it takes me so much effort to get in here in Brooklyn. So, you know, propagation can be a mysterious thing. But if anyone local to the metropolitan area has any questions tonight of a technical nature, or comments to make, or topics to bring up, please hit that push-to-talk button.
WS2N, I don't hear any other repeater except ours out here in Selden, Roy, just to let you know.
Okay, it's probably my juxtaposition in Brooklyn.
Okay, you're doing very good. I don't know if you have your linear on or not, but right now you're doing good with however many watts you're putting in. Doing good.
Okay, very good. Unfortunately, yeah, I'm still doing the 150 watts. I set up a Yagi over the weekend. It's supposed to be a 10 decibel gain. Unfortunately, the direction to hit the Limark repeater goes right through a co-op apartment across the street from me. It's 8 stories high. So when I figured out what the gain effectively was, it broke even with my other antennas. And the problem with the Diamond Yagi is that it's only rated for 50 watts. So I couldn't use my linear for it. So I went back to one of my Comets. I went back to my Comet GP6. So using the same old antennas, unfortunately, and apparently requiring the same 150 watts. What can you do?
Okay, well, very good. I guess they'll fix the antenna Sunday soon, and then those problems will go away. But right now you're doing good.
Very good. Now all I need is guys on the other end of the radio. So if you're out there and you have any questions, there's usually questions out there. I don't know anyone, including myself, who knows everything. Or topics you want to discuss, or things that you found out that you would like to discuss that have to do with amateur radio technology or other aspects of amateur radio. This is a good opportunity. Please, hit the push to talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
David, KG2RY, good evening.
Good evening, David. Okay, I have you down on the list. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Please, hit that push to talk button.
Kilo Delta 2, Victor Hotel Delta, Jim.
Okay, Jim recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down?
Hi, Ryan. This is Jeff, AB6F. Question on radials versus counterpoints. Where to use them, where not to use them. Thank you, AB6MB.
Okay, very good. Jeff is the host of the Papa Network on the West Coast weekly antenna TechNet. I listen to it, I record it every Friday night. He's on the Papa Network. So glad to have you, Jeff. Okay, we'll put you down on the list. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list for any topics, any questions, any comments, any observations they might have, or telling me the rest of the story of where they tried to do a bunch of things and what the results were, so we can all learn from them. Okay, so we'll start with David, KG2RY. What's your question or topic for tonight, David?
Well, good evening, Roy. I think it's a continuation of a topic that we've been discussing. I guess the question is, many radios have built-in speakers. I want to talk about the quality of the audio for ease of communication. My Kenwood, a dual band radio, has a speaker on the top near the back. My HF radio, Yaesu FT891, also has a speaker on the top in the back. For the most part, built-in speakers sound really good. But on the HF, you know, I seem to be able to hear clearly, more clearly, with a small external speaker. And simple, I think, is good. On the Kenwood, the speaker in the radio sounds better, but it isn't always as clear as it could be. Back to you, sir.
Okay, very good, David. Well, you know, internal speakers are certainly more convenient than external speakers. They take up less space. You don't have to make yet another decision, although many companies make a couple extra bucks by selling you color-coordinated enclosures speakers that sit on the side of the radio that you bought from them. But it's more a convenience factor than a quality. You can have good sound coming from the speaker in the box if they both chose a high-quality speaker with a good cone and put it in the right place with the right accessories to limit the resonances and rattling noises that might be caused by the sounds of the speaker. So it requires a reasonably decent electrical engineer, maybe a sound engineer or someone with experience with sound complications, and a manufacturer willing to pay more than a few cents for a speaker top. So the upshot is that there are a lot of radios with built-in speakers of varying quality and varying locations. Unfortunately, a great deal of the time I find it seems like that they position the speaker to be more convenient for the rest of the components rather than to optimize the delivery of the sound quality. Some of them are bottom based with a raised base, so they bounce off the bottom and you hear it. Some, very few, are located in the front, which probably to me is the most advantageous because it doesn't require any kind of bounce thought. It just goes straight into your head. A lot of them go to the top and they bounce all around, and a few of them probably even in the back. So again, more of a second thought, I think, on their part. So it depends upon the model and the manufacturer and the efforts that they put in. They could be good, bad, and or indifferent. A separate speaker, to me, is usually better. You have to kind of look around and find something that particularly suits you. You certainly need one that is electronically shielded, because you're going to be dealing one way or another with RF and EMI. For poorly shielded external, either powered or unpowered speakers, the amplifier to power them is going to be required to be shielded. So it makes life more complicated. I tend to use external speakers myself, again, because I just like the better quality of the sound, and you can do more things with it. So,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Well, that was the longest timeout that I could recall. I didn't time it personally, but it sounded like a heck of a long time. So I don't know, David, how much you got and how much you didn't. I mentioned towards the end that although it is possible to engineer a good quality speaker inside the chassis, I tend to go with external ones because you'll definitely get what you pay for and what you what you listen to with external speakers. Whereas every new model of radio has its own quality, shall we say?
QSL. I have Rode Pro from Amazon. I think it's $14, you know? It sounds great, and I can direct the sound right to me, and I can hear more of the signal and less of the noise with it. Inside my ST891, there are settings for, equalizer settings, you know, for receiving 100 to 3,000 hertz, 200 to 2,800 hertz, and 300 to 2,600 hertz. You choose the one that you want. So depending on what speaker I'm listening through, I decide what equalizer setting I want. I also have an ICOM IC718 with a front-firing speaker. I'd like to hear what that sounds like.
Okay, I mean, we live in a time now of digital signal processor chips. They probably cost less than a dollar, judging by what happens with the price of these things over years. And it's very easy for them to manipulate and equalize the audio. So you can fix a problematic speaker that has harmonics and resonances that kind of some frequencies and a lack of emphasis in others. Yeah, it's always good to kind of start, if you can, with something with a reasonable roll off to begin with, and then you could just use those controls to tweak it your heart's content. Whatever works for you. Like I said, the only thing that I caution people about with inexpensive powered external speakers is that they're not equally shielded against RF. So it's usually easier to have RF get into them and cause howling and other audio artifacts from them. So, if it worked out for you, that's great.
QSL, I agree. And I'll also say that, for RF, passive speakers are best.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul. I just want to comment that you're kind of just passing the problem to another component. Passive speakers will not be affected by RF because of the amount of current that has to go through them. So then you have to worry about the amplifier device. If the amplifier device is shielded, you're in. It's the amplification circuits that are usually screwed up by RF going into them in an unshielded way. But, Paul, you wanted to say something.
Yes, you talked about the speakers on the bottom, and some of them, of course, have that. I have the ICOM, it's 2 meter, ICOM 2100H, and there's a series of them, and they put all the speakers on the bottom. But they always give you the brackets, to mount in the car. So if you're using it for, bass for, not in the car, but you put it on the desk and, it's really no good. So you take the bracket, you mount the bracket on the bottom of the unit, you put that bracket on the top or on the bottom, you put it on the bottom, you attach it, in my case, to a nice piece of wood. And now it's elevated, like you were saying earlier. If it's elevated, no problem. And that's what I do with mine. But just to get away from the speaker on the bottom problem, back to you, Roy.
WB2KWC.
Yes, Ken.
Okay, I have the IC7300, which has the speakers firing out of the top. Not the greatest thing in the world, but most of the time, if I really need to listen to something, I'm wearing a pair of headphones, or I don't use the audio at all for something like FT4 and FT8. But one of the recommendations, if you've got a top-firing speaker, is to simply take a PVC right-angle elbow, at least, I guess, about 4 inches in diameter or more. Place it on top of the speaker, one end on top of the speaker, and the other end just pointing toward you, so it kind of shoots the sound out of the front rather than out of the top.
Okay, that's good advice as well. Yeah, you end up needing to fudge some acoustic reflector. The best position in my book for a speaker is pointed at your head. My two speakers here at Mission Control, that the computer comes out and the radio comes out, are both pointed directly at me on my right hand and my left hand. So you want it straight shooting, and some good acoustical engineers or electrical engineers that know acoustics can design different implements to operate as acoustic reflectors. And that's nice when they do that. But when they don't, you could always jury-rig something yourself, either by building some kind of a base with an angled reflective surface, if it's a bottom-mounted speaker, or, as Ken mentioned, something to reflect the acoustic waves back at you in the front, using some piece of a reflective acoustic material. You don't want absorbent material. That serves a different purpose entirely. You want something nice and reflective to just bounce it to your head. Any other comments on this in general out there? Anyone have any fixes or
preferences of speakers and such?
Well, I think the quality of sound, it varies from radio to radio, whether the speakers on the top, on the bottom, or in the front. And it also varies whatever speaker you're going to plug into it, and then it varies from radio to radio. So I spent some time experimenting with this, and thank you very much for your information.
Well, you're welcome, David. Yeah, I mean, it's there are a lot of variables. The signal itself, the front end of the receiver, the IF stages can introduce variations in the modulated signal, the digital signal processor, the amplification circuit that finally feeds the speaker either internally or externally. And then you have the characteristics of those speakers, enclosures, and the possible extra power, amplification circuits for powered external speaker systems. So I wish you continued luck with it. Audio is a very important aspect of our hobby. Some people embrace it to the point where I see on some QRZ pages, guys have racks of audio equipment. I'm not quite sure what you do with racks of it. I understand an equalizer. I might even understand some compressors, expanders, and gates. But when you get past about two pieces of chassis-built equipment, I don't know what the extra audio components are doing for these people, but they enjoy dealing a lot with the audio aspect of the hobby. Most people just, don't even adjust their equalizer settings on their radios. They just take them out of the box and start talking. So whatever floats one's boat. But thank you, David, for participating. Next on our list is Jim, KD2VHD. What's your question or topic tonight, Jim?
Good evening, Roy. Sorry about your troubles with your antenna, but I must tell you, you're coming halfway to Montauk on the right by the shore beautifully. You don't have to do anything with your antennas. Working very nice. So I'm back with a repeat question. I was wondering, I'm still experimenting and trying to learn how to make a NVIS off-center fed dipole dual band 40 and 80, or possibly 80 and 160. I was wondering if anybody had any other ideas other than what we talked about in the past.
Okay, I'll open it to the gang. I don't want to repeat myself too much. The primary difference between a near vertical incident sky wave dipole and a non-incident, the usual one for DXing, is simply the location. Locating it close to the ground where reflections will build up and cause the sky wave to be straight up, whereas with DX you want it to have a much more horizontal takeoff angle. So, my two cents worth was build it close enough to the ground that you're not coupling and losing too much energy to the ground, but enough that the reflections and such are distorting the takeoff angle to a near vertical incident. But please, anyone out there with any other ideas on the subject, please hit that push to talk button.
Alpha Bravo 6, Mike Bravo.
Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, the good point about the on the antenna. I haven't been, but I have heard of putting multiple wires down underneath it to help it reflect. You know, probably an optimum number of wires or one work, is it two better, three better, and so on. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I would guess what you were doing with that wouldn't be quite as much as improving the reflection off the ground, although it would do that as well. but also blocking the coupling to ground and losing a lot of energy to warming up the soil and, you know, making the earthworms happy. So most likely, if you were going to do something like that, the more wire would be better. In the past, people thought they were going to be clever, and they put down, because radio waves don't really need solid metal conductors. They will treat holes in their conductors as invisible things if it is smaller than its wavelength. So they use things like chicken wire and such to simulate basically just a solid metal-clad base in the ground. The problem with that, though, is over time, the places where the wire is intertwined develop corrosion, and each of those corrosion points produce nonlinear signals. So they act as little diodes all over the darn place, and they produce, rather than reflecting a nice, clean signal, they'll basically act as a crystal detector. And they'll give you a mix of all kinds of frequencies. So yeah, a bunch of wires next to each other will probably improve the reflection to a degree, and more importantly, limit the amount of ground coupling.
It's an interesting concept. I hadn't thought of that. That could certainly complicate the issue.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is you can't, you know, although the closer to ground, the more you probably are going to get a near vertical incident sky wave. The closer to ground, the more you'll get the coupling. So that's why you never see, or almost never see, people putting a dipole up on the ground, because that's not going to work. So you have to find a happy medium where your takeoff angle is sufficient, but your coupling and efficiencies are reasonable. And, you know, if you find a sweet spot like that and you want to experiment to see if you could tweak efficiency, then you might want to consider putting down those kinds of conductors on the ground below the dipole to see if you can sort of tweak it and improve the signal.
Roger. Sounds like a good direction. All right, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Jim. Anyone else with any thoughts on the subject, please hit that push to talk button. Okay, very well. So, Jeff, could you restate your question again?
Okay, Roy, thank you. Yeah, let me rephrase it. Basically, you know, we use radios with, we came up this last week on we use radio wave and counterpoint with a half wave. Excuse me, not inset half wave, but with a could be that too, but in wire antenna monopole. And so I'm looking at the what is the probably the optimum. The reason I'm asking this is I have my favorite antenna. Is a 29-foot vertical end-fed with a 17-foot counterpoise, and I use that to load up on 40 through meters. Now, however, it's only, you know, one point, am I losing a lot of power heating up the ground, or and then so on, if I don't use additional counterpoises to kind of be like radials. I hope I made that clear. Back to you, Roy, 86M.
Yeah, Jeff. Really, ultimately, when push comes to shove and the laws of physics are considered, radials and counterpoises are the identical element. The only difference is by the term used, radials are constructed and placed to radiate away from the central monopole. So they're radial wires. So they're called radials, but they act as counterpoises. Now, when you have an object that's in free space, you don't need any protection from ground coupling. All you need is some form of counterpoise to offset the current that's going in through the monopole. The only problem, though, is that the counterpoise will introduce a distortion in the omnidirectionality of your radiator. In other words, if you take a quarter wave antenna, mobile antenna, that uses your car as its ground plane, if you position it in your back bumper so that your ground plane is in front, of the car, your directionality for that antenna will tend to go forward instead of truly omnidirectional. So you introduce a degree of directionality. If you take three pieces of wire, three radials, and separate them each by 120 degrees, you cover all your bases, and you return to that nice omnidirectional presentation. Let me drop for a sec. So all that radios that are in free space need are three elements to provide a reasonably good omnidirectional radiation path. Some people use four, six of one, half a dozen of the other, as the old saying goes. The problem is that as you get closer and closer to Earth, you have a problem with ground coupling. So what happens is, rather than the free space phenomena, some of your RF is going to go right into the ground, be turned into waste heat, and will never reach anyone in the ionosphere. So in that case, you're using the radials for two different things. You're using them to offset the current in the monopole, but you're also using them to shield against ground. That becomes increasingly more important the closer you get to the ground, such that verticals that are placed straight on the ground generally need something in the neighborhood of 36 different radial elements to properly shield itself. There are people who use more than that. There are people who use less than that. Most of the people who kind of experimented seem to find that in the 30s is the sweet spot.
Okay, thank you. So I'll remember that 36 number. Yeah, it makes more sense now. I have seen when I model the antenna, I do see that the omnidirectional is on where the counterpoise and three down there. You'll spread it out around. Okay, that's a great answer. Thank you very much. 86MB.
You're welcome, Jeff. Thank you for participating. Once again, Jeff AB6MB is the guy running Papa's West Coast Antenna Technical Net every Friday night, local time around 10 o'clock it begins. So if you are familiar with the Papa Network and have some means of listening, I think Echolink is one source. They have some DSAR. Yeah, they have DSAR repeaters. So take a look at Papa Network. It's a very popular thing on the West Coast, and a lot of very, very smart, clever people, and Jeff is one of them, and there are other people who show up on his antenna technical net who are quite clever with radio waves, so avail yourself of that, please. Anyway, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limar Technical Net. If there's anyone else with any amateur-related technical questions, comments, topics, or want to tell me about something that they tried and whether they succeeded or failed, hit the push-off button, give me your first name and your call sign. Gosh, going to be a slow night. Okay, well, we'll open it up to a little bit of everything. And I still have Paul's excellent puzzle to offer you guys. We'll see a nice period of calm and quiet and sat out for you. But, you know, if anyone has any general science questions or general, try our best. Just hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign.
Net Control, AC2PL, Jeff.
Hello, Jeff. How are you tonight?
Yeah, not bad, Roy. I'm just wondering if we're allowed to talk about certain international radio issues at this time.
Certainly.
All right, very good. Just wondering about all these Facebook posts I'm seeing on the various ham radio groups I belong to about supposed, alleged jamming on various bands by unknown parties. I really don't know if you want to talk about it, if it's wise to do so, but I mean, you opened it up, so I thought I'd bring that up because I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about it.
Yeah, I would think that it's all right. I haven't even gotten the vaguest sense that it's been politicized, although eventually, like all things, it will be. But I don't think it's quite yet. The way it was presented to me in different bits and pieces on the Internet was that they were kind of pointing fingers at Cuba. Cuba has been having a lot of political unrest, very closely, obviously, located to the United States. There are amateur radio operators who operate out of Cuba, and my surmise was that the government there would prefer to have no one talk to strangers. But I could be wrong, but I think that that's what the illusion was. I even remember there were recordings, I think it was on YouTube that I saw it, where people recorded attempts to use the 40-meter band, I think, and they showed that there were these spikes of noise at multiple frequencies that they remarked they had spoken to Cuban hams on in previous times.
ACTPL. Well, that's what I'm hearing too, Roy, and I'm not sure how much credit to place in it because, you know, on 20 and 40, you can hear things from a vast distance, and it could really be coming from anywhere. I saw one YouTube thing where they claimed that they had triangulated it, however, and, you know, we hear other things throughout the years and on various websites about number stations that they haven't been able to identify, so I really wonder how much credence to place in it all.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's always a question. The thing that, kind of caught my sensibilities is that it makes the most amount of sense if you were going to jam a bunch of frequencies. What area close to the United States, and I agree with you, 40 meters can travel kind of long, but it's easier to pick up the noise from something as close as Cuba. That seems to strike me as the major place where people want to shut up amateur radio operators or any radio operators. You know, I don't see it happening in Eastern Europe right now. There's nothing particularly special that I'm aware of going on in Eastern Europe. There's nothing special in Africa. There's nothing special even in Asia. It seems to be fortuitous that, you know, Cuba has gotten a little bit of a turmoil in the last few weeks. So it may be just a coincidence. Those numbered stations are most likely longtime spy broadcasters. They transmit encoded messages, and, you know, we've played that game. The Russians played that game. I'm sure the Chinese played it as well. So I tend to believe in number stations, again, because it sort of makes sense to me.
All right, Roy. I didn't want to rile anyone up. Certainly not our big brothers elsewhere in the Northeast here. But I just wanted to kind of open it up to the floor. Maybe someone else wanted to ask a question as well. Because I did see a couple of posts on Facebook where people were even suggesting that we weren't supposed to talk about it, and I thought that might be a little bit unusual. So I'm happy to hear that you think that it's not necessarily a forbidden topic. Certainly something of kind of forensic or physical, from a physics standpoint, physics interest to myself, and I'm sure many other hams. with nice beams, unlike mine, who could do a bit of direction finding with their friends spread out over the country and some of the other continents. Anyway, thanks very much, Roy, and and the number stations are also a fascinating topic, so at your leisure. AC2PL, back to net, and I will be listening.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff. Yeah, I've always found the number stations interesting. I think at one point they even made it into the X-File, if I recall correctly. So, that's always a nice thing to see. Although the X-File did weird things. They actually had an episode that was supposed to be taking place very close to me in Brighton. It was about the newly immigrated Russian community in Brighton, but because they filmed in Vancouver, they tried to make Vancouver look like Brighton, and apparently there is no place in Vancouver that looks anything like Brighton, so that was unfortunate. But I hate when things that are not really political, like the radio wave signals, get turned into political fodder. Maybe if this net was taking place in Florida, where, Cuba still gets a lot of people upset. And in the past, I've sort of tried to play down the death rays that were supposedly being sent to diplomatic people in Americans in Cuba. But again, this sort of makes a lot of sense to me. I have no particular proof, so it might turn out to be something completely different. If anyone else out there has any ideas on this subject, is curious about it, has looked into it, or has any opinions, please feel free to hit that push to talk button.
KD2, Victor Hotel Delta.
Yes.
This week on 40 meters, and I can't say what the noise is, but it certainly has a purposeful man-made sound to it. It doesn't sound natural. It sounds like something that's created. There's a pattern. You can see it on a pan adapter. It's got a pattern to it. It's got a just seems something purposeful. That's non-scientific, but it's just my thought. The other side of it is that apparently the government there shut down the internet and they went to ham radio as the backup. And I could never have it here, of course.
Well, you never know. I'm always amused by people's lack of understanding of what the internet is. There was a great British comedy called The IT Crowd. Where they were trying to fool their manager, and they brought in a small box with a big red button on it, and they said, "This is the internet. Make sure not to press the red button, because that's the emergency off switch. So shut down the entire internet." But, a lot of autocratic countries have learned to put switches on the conduits that go in and out of their country. They're well documented and not that difficult for them to do it. It's the first move of a tyrant is to shut up your citizens.
Agreed, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay, we don't want to do a political net here. I used to, in the old days, joke that the political net starts at about 12:07 in the morning. Anyone else with any thoughts or experiences? Have you heard strange signals on HF that don't sound as though they're just QRM, but obvious methods to block transmission?
WB2BX, Frank.
Yes, Frank.
Roy, WB2BXO here.
Yes, Frank, please.
Okay, I know that EchoLink is a little cranky sometimes, so I didn't want to go ahead and transmit until it was acknowledged, which of course is always good practice. In any case, even on the real radio. Well, we know, first of all, that some of the strange noises we hear on HF, and especially those that come up whenever the situation gets tense in the Middle East and South Asia, are the OTHB, or over-the-horizon backscatter radars, which operate throughout the HF spectrum to detect missiles. Of course, the most famous of those was a Russian woodpecker that was shut down, located near Chernobyl, that was shut down in 1986. That was the one I heard a lot when I was a kid. So I guess for a new 40-meter noise, that's possible, and it would certainly make sense to me that with a situation tense down there, that one side or the other would crank up their missile radars. I was wondering how long it would take for that to happen. The other thing I've been checking on every couple of nights, if not every night, as to whether Cubans were still on the air. And no, I haven't noticed them today. I'm not on all that much, honestly, because I rent the station online and get on for a few minutes at a time. But last night I noticed some Cuban stations on FT8 and a couple of nights this week. So the Cuban hands are still on the air, at least on FT8, for whatever that's worth. Go ahead.
Well, it's good to hear. Doesn't really take away from the general possibility, because you know, FT8 is a wonderful technology that imparts absolutely no information other than technical. So you're not going to have freedom comments coming through on FT8. FT8 is localized in a very narrow band, and there's only so much electromagnetic energy any country could spit out into the world. So if I was in charge of the guy jamming, I would probably not bother with the FT8 portion of the band. I would go primarily for the phone and secondarily for the CW area.
Well, yeah, the thing is, one of the easiest and first things you would expect the regime to do is to order the hands off the air and possibly to take away their equipment. I'll tell you my only closest thing to direct experience I've had with this sort of thing is I was in the Caribbean on a neighboring island. I think it was Dominica at the time, when there was an attempted coup in the nation of TNT, Trinidad and Tobago, which many people in Brooklyn are familiar with. And we were talking, I think, on maybe 40 or 80 meters to amateurs on the island who are not identifying themselves except saying, we are in the affected area or we are in the war zone. And they would communicate with us, and on 20 meters was K3DOS, which was, and I think at the time, is the State Department station. And I think about the only time you hear them on is under that call. The only way they have to communicate with people in the area is via amateur radio. So I don't really monitor enough. But as far as I know, there's no operation of that type going on just yet. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, but we could just be in the early phase of whatever is going on down south. You know, most of the YouTubes that I've seen pop up are usually Florida or really southern state related. So, I don't know. It's up in the air. When I heard the report of the death rays back in the old days, it didn't ring true to me, and it still doesn't ring true to me. I still think that psychological components to it might be confusing to you. But this doesn't strike me as anything like that. You know, you'd have to have people roll up large microwave transmitters that weigh a ton outside of a person's apartment and shoot it at them without anyone bothering to notice. But it'll be interesting to see what happens. Hopefully we'll get follow-up. My guess is whatever it is that's going on in Cuba will probably just kind of dispense eventually. I tend to be a political pessimist. And then the jamming, if there is jamming, will disappear, and everyone will kind of shrug their shoulders and say, gee, I wonder what that was.
My Cuban situation is going to take many months to play out. Hopefully, amateur radio will not play a big role in that. It's great when amateur radio gets involved in natural disasters, but when amateur radio gets involved in wars and directions around the world, that makes me kind of nervous about the potential fate of amateur radio. Anyway, back to Detroit, WB2BXO.
Okay, very good, Frank. Thank you for participating. Part of politics is communicating. So getting access to devices that enable you to communicate offers you some degree of political power. So, even going back historically, I believe at the onset of World War II, the powers that be in the government basically shut down all of amateur radio. There were some limited options for people who weren't drafted, who could operate on some frequencies under government guidance, but amateur radio as a hobby kind of took a break during our time in World War II. So I'm sure that if they had a good infrastructure and could just shut everyone down, they very likely will, and for all we know, they are slowly doing it. They don't strike me, and I could be completely wrong, as a country with a very strong infrastructure of getting things done efficiently and quickly. So I guess on the one end, there's a couple of guys jamming, and the other guy, a group of guys going house to house to shut people down. But that's conjecture on my part. I look forward to reading real facts in the newspapers one of these days. Anyone else with any comments on this subject, please hit that push to talk button.
AC2PL, quick comment.
Yes, Jeff.
This brings back a kind of a quick memory. So I used to speak with a lot of guys over on the Alpine repeater over in New Jersey. And every once in a while, there would be some unbelievable amount of noise, and it was definitely not a natural noise. It was definitely something that was being generated that took out that repeater, and then we'd try to QSY to other repeaters, and all of them were being affected in the kind of Manhattan area. And it correlated, every single time it happened, it correlated with activity at the UN building. So I'm going to throw that out there. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but there are definitely things that happen when there are people that really don't want to be heard doing something or don't want other people talking about some other things. I don't know. It seems to be true. Again, apocryphal evidence, but true nonetheless, and I'm not the only person who heard it. We all were talking as much as we could on the air and using our cell phones as well. Go ahead, Rick.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, like I've always said, one aspect of political power is being able to control the conversation. If you could silence the guy on the other end, it's a lot easier to win your argument. So totalitarian countries and all manner of human beings tend to try and shut up their opponents. When they use technology, it kind of bleeds over to the rest of us, and we sit around and wonder what the heck was that about. But, nowadays it's shutting down Internet access. It's shutting down applications of third-party companies that are being blackmailed by strong governments who can shut down their profit motive for that area. So there's a lot of people attempted to be silent through history. It's just the method used changes with the technology of the communication.
Roger that, Roy. AC2PL. And I think that most of the hams that I know are essentially interested in the hobby. They're interested in communicating and talking about the hobby. and following the precepts that we have set forth here by the FCC and by essentially ham radio in the United States to advance the hobby. We look forward to making sure that that happens. And I don't know, it troubles me though sometimes when you see that it's being used as a tool. Anyway, I'll say 7-3 for now, and thank you very much for hosting the night. You do a great job.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. I appreciate your participation. And, you know, when it comes to comments, when we use the word tool, I kind of unfortunately always fall back to the same analogy that hammer is a very powerful tool. You can use it to build a new house, and you can also use it to bash in your neighbor's golf. So tools are amoral. They don't have a good. They don't have an evil. It's the people who implement them. And as there are wonderful amateur radio operators all over the world that operate radios based on friendship and fraternity, and now I've noticed they've added sorority to it, you know, most of the guys that you meet on the air are friendly guys trying to enjoy themselves by operating radio equipment and by contacting people and exchanging ideas and opinions and what have you. There's always some people out there who look at a tool and try and figure out how much you can break things with it. And that's the case with radio waves as well. But overwhelmingly, the majority of amateur radio operators, I think, are a great bunch of people with noble ideals. So I look forward to continuing conversations with them through the years on these radio waves. That said, once again, I am Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, AC2GS, and my name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and this is the Limewire Technical Net. It's been going on since 1982. So please, if you have any questions, either of a technical nature or scientific nature, please hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
Intuition.
Yes, Wesley.
The switch to radio on, I've heard a part of the information of conversation. We're talking about Woodpecker, Russian over horizon radar, that was mentioned noises, and friction.
Yes, Wesley, it was a comment. The original point was that some amateur radio bands of the 40 and 20 meters have been receiving unusual noises that have been blocking signals, and there has been some concern among amateur radio operators that this might be an attempt at the Cuban government having shut down the internet, trying to effectively shut down the radio waves. So as an aside, we went back to the good old days of the woodpeckers and the number stations that that used to be all over the place. Okay. Wesley, unfortunately, let me see if I have this. Okay, we must have woken a troll. Well, apparently that was a demonstration of what's going on in Cuba today. So, I hope you all learned something.
The medal cover has followed us. Thanks more and guys.
Should move on to another subject and no more examples.
Good.
Okay, very good. Let's shift gears here. Let's take on a interesting puzzle question. Let me drop to make sure that nothing weird is happening in my background. Okay, we're weird free. That's good. This was an interesting puzzle that Paul sent me an email suggesting it. I tweaked it a little bit. So I offer it to you, ladies and gentlemen, for what it's worth. And hopefully we can sort of discuss the subject and revisit things that I've mentioned in the past that might have faded from memory. Paul's question was, if you were given a COVID vaccine 1 week ago, and now you go to donate blood, what do you think would happen when you advise the Red Cross employees that you had just had a COVID-19 vaccine 4 or 5 days ago? So I'll give you 4 different choices for an answer. You know, it's a little bit more complicated than them, but it's a good starting off point. Choice A is it depends upon which vaccine you were given. Choice B is they'll have to filter it out of your blood sample before they give it to someone else. Choice C is they'll tell you that you can't donate and send you away. And choice D is they'll tell you that you have to wait some time to donate. So anyone out there want to hazard a guess of what the Red Cross lady will tell you?
WB2KW3?
Yes, Ken.
Okay, I'm thinking in my ideal world, in short, take your blood. It will not be transfused into a person, but we're going to study, I guess, the effects of the vaccine.
Okay, that's an interesting answer. I think the problem with that is that I don't think the Red Cross really is in a position to do that. I guess they could act as a conduit to offer that to laboratories. It would be sort of wasteful to take a whole pint of your blood to send for testing. Probably a vial would be sufficient. But that's apparently not one of the things that the Red Cross people have been told to do. Just to triple-check myself, I've actually researched the FDA recommendations for the Red Cross.
Okay, agreed that it would be, wasteful of the blood. I know when they take blood, they have, they collect a whole bunch of little vials as the remnants of what's in the tube. So I guess they could just use those vials and not collect the entire pint.
Yes, I would agree. But, I don't think there's any kind of
of plan for that. They're kind of probably keeping the test of vaccinated people to a list that they have well documented and selected beforehand, and they're just following those people as opposed to random collections of blood donations. So we're sort of back. It's a curious answer that ultimately confuses me a little bit, which we'll go into as this puzzle progresses. But there is a legitimate FDA-approved answer to the question of what should happen at Red Cross if a person presents themselves with a history of recently being vaccinated against COVID-19, of how to deal with them and whether to accept them, deny them, or do something weird in the middle.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul, this was your question, so please, what would you think would be the best answer?
I'm thinking that there's got to be a way to filter it out. But the reason I came up with the question is because, you know, you watch the news and they'll talk about blood shortages, you know, Channel 12 out in Long Island here and you know, CNN, they talk about that quite a bit, that there is a shortage. So, you know, it would be a heck of a thing if they're throwing everything out just because you got the vaccine. Or maybe they're keeping it. So, I don't know. I'm going to go with a filter. Try to filter it out.
Okay. That's a reasonable answer. You spin down the blood anyway. So the serum is not... The serum is stored separately. So... Usually when someone takes a unit of blood, they don't just kind of hold on to it like that. They tend to process it in different ways. They'll spin it down and have the plasma in one bag. Sometimes they'll take the platelets for a separate bag, and they'll have the packed red blood cells for a third because of the, you know, most of the antibodies would probably be in the plasma. You would have a decrease in the concentration. You couldn't really clean it entirely of the spike protein. The point, though, is that it's probably not dangerous to have the spike proteins anyway. It will not confer as much immunological resistance as a proper vaccination or a proper infection. It'll give you maybe a little bit marginal exposure to your immune system to recognize it and produce some degree of antibodies, but it wouldn't be, the choice that the FDA came up with is not removal of the vaccine material from the blood that they donate.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George, by the way, this is AC2GF.
Yeah, I was going to jump in initially with the advice, give it a little time, and then come back and donate. Two reasons. For one, the vaccination is entered into your body and allow for hematological stabilization to occur. That is good for your body, good for your type, everything about your blood. And number two, it's good that we got to see how you in general react with 1/11th of your blood being missing after you receive something that you know you may not be stable with. So I would say the advice is give it a little time.
Okay, George, that is a reasonable thing to tell people, and I don't think if the life-threatening problems of a blood supply shortage existed, they might just use that very general and very reasonable response. But I guess because of the problems of blood shortage, they don't feel that they can quite do that. So that is what the FDA is telling the Red Cross to do.
K7WJN.
Yes, WJN.
I got through. That's great.
Okay. Hey, this is K7WJN Phoenix, and handle is Bill, make it India Lima Lima, and I'm going to answer the question. I'm going to say that the entities involved said, get that blood and get all you can. K7WJN.
Okay, Bill, and it's a pleasure to hear you. I see you on my Echo Link window week in and week out, and I do appreciate that you come by and listen to us, and I'm particularly happy that you're participating us today. I hear the slight tone of the modern-day cynicism of government and such. Let me assuage that a little bit, hopefully, and say that they demonstrate something weird to me personally, but they don't demonstrate quite that degree of personal disregard. So they don't take the tack of come on and give us as much blood as you want. There are qualifiers that even to me don't quite make a great deal of sense, again, which will be hopefully obvious when I explain it to you.
Yeah, my second choice would be, I would agree with the last station, wait a while and then come back so the system could stabilize, and if there's going to be any adverse reactions or anything's going to be in, then they could see it. So that would be my second choice. My first choice would be, give us all the blood you got, and then my second choice would be, moderation would be, go away for a while and then come back so we could see if, it didn't react with you adversely. K7WJM.
Okay, Bill, and that is, to a degree, part of the answer. One portion, which makes perfect sense to me, is the FDA requested that they ask people if the people who had the vaccine vaccinated themselves, whether they had any kind of impact, whether they weren't quite feeling right, the so-called mind fog of very common for the second of the messenger RNA vaccines. If they had any complaints, aches or pains or brain fog, that they should go home and come back later. But that's only one half of the FDA's recommendation. The other half, as I said, is a little confusing to me.
Yeah, I could see vaccine is looked at as genetic engineering, and having said that, once a person is injected, they just don't know what monsters are invented, and they want to make sure that they're not injecting any monsters into any unsuspecting donors. K7WJN.
Okay, well, I understand that we live in the world of genetically modified organisms in agriculture and elsewhere. The messenger RNA technology is actually not, it doesn't do DNA. DNA is what sits in our nucleuses. This is a very specialized form of messenger RNA, which is used by our cells to send the blueprints to the factories of the organelles in the cell body to manufacture protein. So the messenger RNA-based vaccines don't really have genetic transcription. They're just little segments of blueprints that when they get into the cell are misrecognized as your body's as your body's blueprint. And they just code for a lot of spike proteins, which then leak through the cell membrane and produce a immune response. So it's not going to affect anyone's DNA. This is not CRISPR. This is not that Chinese guy who tried to genetically engineer some fetuses so that they would be resistant to HIV. So you don't have to unduly be worried that these vaccines are changing your DNA, because there's no indication and it doesn't make any sense that it would.
Hey, C2PL, query.
The last thought would be they would send you away and tell you a PCR test and make sure that you come up negative, and then bring that results back to them, and they'll let you donate.
Hey, if you could be out query.
Okay, Jeff recognized, just the bill. That's a reasonable one to find out if the person is infectious. It really, you could use the same logic, though, for people who weren't vaccinated. Matter of fact, it's more likely if you use the logic for people who weren't vaccinated, that all things being equal, it would be nice to test everyone with serology. Well, not really with serology, because by then you've built an immune status, and there's nothing particularly wrong with getting vaccinated and having an immune response. So it would be more of the earlier test to see if you were actively shedding the viruses that would probably negate your ability to give blood as a donation. Jeff, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, Roy, this is just a strictly hypothetical question. Suppose you're given an mRNA vaccine. The mRNA finds its way to a cell in your body, which is undergoing active infection by a retrovirus. Pick a retrovirus of choice. So in that retrovirus, you already have an RT-PCR event occurring for other reasons. Is it just possible, not probable, but possible, that you could have an RT-PCR event where it's followed by an integrase event where that piece of DNA would be incorporated into the genome of that particular cell? Believe me, I know how improbable this is, but I'm just asking if it's at all, even however improbable, possible.
I guess theoretically it's possible. In addition to having a juxtaposition of another virus capable of reverse transcription, you'd have to get the messenger RNA into the nucleus. I don't know whether you have to set up some kind of a possibility where for some odd reason it would be there. I don't know why it would be there. It's kind of, nucleus is kind of has its own protection system that I realize some viruses can assault, but a simple strand of messenger RNA, as far as I'm aware, pretty much goes one direction. But yeah, it's possible. It's highly, highly, highly unlikely. And it affecting a stem cell or a germ layer that is going to go off and produce multiple copies is not really great either. So floor of averages is it'll affect the cell that sits there and then just dies by itself.
So you're telling me, Roy, I should write books instead of do science?
Well, we always need hard science fiction writers out there. I miss them a great deal. All that I have to read is sorcerers and magicians and guys walking around with dragons and swords. So if you have any literary aspirations, please.
Well, I think we all wish that Michael Crichton was here. But yeah, it's occurred to a lot of us that there are a lot of weird possibilities out there, and obviously things we worry about and try to capitalize on towards therapeutics, certainly not towards, how shall we say, gain of function, which is, in my opinion, not a way to go. Anyway, I'm going to QSY. I've got another net to go to. Roy, thank you so much for what you do. Thank you, and back to Matt.
Okay, thank you, Jeff, and 73. I realize you have other things you got to do tonight. There is a weird chiropractor out there on YouTube who does this thing about genetically modified organisms. You know, a lot of plant life has been modified to improve different aspects and be resistant to weed killer toxins and such. And his wacka, you know, his strange little understanding or belief is if these genetically modified organisms go through your gut while staying pretty much alive, they seem to commune with your bacterial gut and create Frankenstein monsters in your intestines. I'm not quite sure what he's basing that on, but you know, that'll probably be an also interesting book to read someplace. So, I'm not that concerned as yet about genetically modified organisms. We thankfully don't have the brains to do too much damage with the manipulations that we've currently played with. But give us time, and no doubt we'll be able to do something really nasty. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS. We still haven't gotten to the end of this puzzle, and I can understand some people probably getting tired of this puzzle. But if anyone has any other ideas of what the Food and Drug Administration, in their infinite wisdom, has advised the Red Cross to do in the nature of people showing up for a blood donation and a story that they had recently been vaccinated, please hit that push-to-talk button. Okay, very well. The closest thing to an answer was A, it depends upon which vaccine you were given. If you, according to the Food and Drug Administration now, if you present to a Red Cross to donate blood and tell them that you just had a vaccine a couple of days ago, they are instructed to ask you which vaccine did you get. They're also told to ask you if you had any side effects. So if you had any side effects, if you're not feeling quite right, they don't want to tempt fate by taking a good portion of your blood. So that'll send you home just by saying that I haven't quite felt right since I took the vaccine. But assuming that that's not the situation, their primary question is, what vaccine did you take? Now, you would think that this means that there are some vaccines in the United States that would not be a good idea to donate blood for. But in the Food and Drug Administration, it says if the person tells you that they've taken any of the messenger RNA, the Pfizer, the Moderna, or if they've taken adenovirus-based vaccines, such as the Johnson & Johnson or the AstraZeneca, then they can donate blood. So that's left me with the question of, well, what vaccine are you not allowed to give blood? And the answer is, from the Food and Drug Administration, if people have had a live viral vaccine, an attenuated live vaccine, they are instructed to come back in 2 weeks to give blood. So that's the answer. Now, my big question is, where the hell are people getting live attenuated vaccines? And as far as I know, no place. I looked and looked and looked. There's a lot of research and development taking place, but the reason